only sort of rehashing the whole story of the relationship between whether it was abolition or slave agency. I mean, I want to do some of that. But my particular interest when I did my PhD a few years ago, I finished, was in the relationship between slave religion, negotiating Christianity, pre-Christian slave religions, and how that helped to formulate and inform slave resistance. So that's what I want to focus on today. Also, I would say that I'm particularly looking at Jamaica as an example of that, but similar things are applicable to other islands in the Caribbean, or in fact throughout the diaspora and diaspora resistance. But I want to look also at the civilizing mission, the Christian mission, as it was pre-slavery, I mean during slavery, and the relationship between that and slave Christian, slave religion. Okay. Basically, I've got a paper, it's an article from something which I wrote some while ago. I'll use that as a basis and embellish and talk through it. If I am running over time, then feel free to, you know, whack me on the head or nudge me and so on, that kind of thing. But I think between Richard and I, we'll do what was originally proposed, that is to basically look at this relationship between the parliamentary campaign and slave agency. Okay. So, forgive the slightly pompous title, it was written for a publication. It's Christianity, Assimilation and Resistance, Negotiating the Civilizing Mission in the History of Jamaica. But it's not going to be like that verbiage. Anyway. In the history of European colonialism, Christianity has often served as a vehicle for the assimilation of indigenous peoples into the new paradigm of empire. But by the same token, evidence of resistance to this may often be traced to ongoing histories of rival religious traditions, many of them existing before the colonial enterprise began. The tension between African, Caribbean and European religiosity that characterized the history of the Anglophone Caribbean in the age of slavery and the post-emancipation period, no less, and which lasted in the 20th century, is the subject of this talk. It's a theme rich in intricate interrelationships and new configurations. What I want to start with is looking at evangelism, and the accommodation of the British churches to slavery. Plant opposition prevented Anglican and denominational missionaries. Denominational missionaries are the church groups that were non-Anglican. These were new religious groups, Baptists and Moravians, that were coming up out of the flowering, out of the Reformation. In the 17th century, these groups were beginning to look at evangelizing the slave populations. But it was plant opposition which prevented the Anglican denominational missionaries in Britain from converting African slaves in the Caribbean until the late 17th century. If the Protestant Reformation had preached that Christians could not enslave their co-religionists, planters feared that conversion might mean freedom. As a result, for much of this early period, African belief systems flourished without serious contact with Christianity. Protestant Christians did not actually agree about what difference, if any, conversion might make to the status of a slave. Would a slave upon baptism become free? In the 17th century, planter control rested upon maintaining the otherness of Africans. For example, the Barbados Slave Codes of 1661 described Africans as heathenish, brutal, and a dangerous kind of people, whose naturally wicked instincts should at all times be suppressed. These sentiments were repeated in the Slave Codes of 1668, with the addition that, in quotes, Africans are wholly unqualified to be governed by the laws, customs, and practices of the English nation. As suggested by the Jamaican historian Hilary Beckles and other scholars, the Slave Code was used to consolidate white interests and to justify extreme measures of control. Just to say a little bit about Jamaican slavery, or slaves throughout the Caribbean, in fact. Brian spoke earlier about the slave codes in the medieval period. Well, when transatlantic slavery came into fruition, fruition is, I guess, a very loaded term, but what they looked at were the old existing slave laws, but slave laws that were used by slaveholding empires beforehand. So the Roman slave code is extremely important. But the Roman slave code was particularly important, I think, for the Catholic powers, and it conferred some degree of rights and status. For the Protestant Reformation countries, this was quite a different issue. And one of their main concerns was that with something, an understanding that came out of the medieval period, in that slaves couldn't, Christians should not enslave fellow Christians. So if you converted a slave to Christianity, would it mean that ipso facto they would have to be free? And so planters wanted to avoid that by basically keeping missionaries away from what they saw as their property. Richard, are you fighting with the mic here? Or jousting with it? We can swap seats later. Okay. Slave revolts, slave conspiracies, and the fear of slave revolt had made the plantocracy suspicious of any move to suggest spiritual equality between master and slave. Planters feared the slaves would translate any suggestion of spiritual equality into ideas of material equality. Many planters also believed that a Christianized slave would become disobedient, and these concerns were expressed in the advice of Barbados gentlemen to the Committee of Trade and Commerce in 1680. And quote, they declare that the conversion of the slaves will not only destroy their property, but endanger the safety of the island, inasmuch as such negroes... It's like listening to Starsky and Hutch here. Anyway, they declare that the conversion of their slaves will not only destroy their property, but endanger the safety of the island, inasmuch as negroes, as are converted, usually grow more perverse. Theological writers in Britain and her American colonies continued to grapple with the problems of evangelization well into the 18th century. The early 18th century witnessed a renewal of humanitarian concern among Anglicans, something which coincided with a growing interest in evangelism, and this particularly among the mercantile class. This is the emergent class rising out of, in opposition to the landed gentry. So you have the formation of the Society for the Propagation of Christian Knowledge, SPCK, and the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel, SPG, in 1698 and 1701 respectively. The new European voyages of discovery presented an opportunity to fulfil a key tenet of Christianity, learning to spread the gospel among the new lands. But saving souls was dependent upon gaining the consent of the plantocracy, and in an attempt to convert the slaves, Christian theologians revived old accommodations of the institution of slavery and arrived at new ones. A number of bishops sought to make a distinction between the material state of slavery and the equality of all before God. So during an annual sermon to the SPG, the Bishop of Chichester reiterated that evangelization would not interfere with slavery, saying, I know nothing as to Christianity that altered men's rights for the sake of it, but such as they are, so they remain till altered by human law. Some bishops also fell back upon the Augustinian division between the material and the physical state. In 1727, for example, Bishop Gibson of London assured American planters that baptism would not have the slightest effect on the outward condition of slaves, saying, freedom which Christianity gives is a freedom from the bondage of sin and Satan, and from the dominion of men's lusts and passions and inordinate desires. But as to their outward condition, whatever that was before, whether bond or free, their being baptized and becoming Christian makes no manner of change in it. Gibson further declared that conversion would make slaves more docile, saying, for Christianity would place slaves under stronger obligations to perform those duties with the greatest diligence and fidelity, not only from fear of men, but from a sense of duty to God. And the Bishop of London's support for slave conversion was particularly important in the Caribbean, as the Caribbean islands fell under his episcopal authority. And the notion that conversion made slaves docile became the key argument used by the SPG. Yet like the Church of England, all other English denominations, with the exception of the Quakers, made similar adjustments to accept slavery. So it's quite important to remember that, I mean, there is quite a powerful history of Baptist resistance to the slave trade. But in actual fact, in the 17th century, that wasn't the case. Most of the dissenting church groups, also made these kind of accommodations. For example, that the flesh of a person was not the same as their spiritual state. So in some, separating the idea of the condition of slaves from the equality of souls. And that was the prime thing for the Christian theologian. In fact, many early evangelicals added new theological adjustments to slavery, not just to give ideological support to the trade, but to see in it a divine plan for spreading the gospel. However, planter resistance undermined legal attempts to enforce slave conversion in any case. The 1696 Jamaica Slave Code stipulated that slave owners should attempt to instruct slaves in Christianity, for example. However, in order to ensure that the program of instruction would not take place, the Jamaican Assembly set the cost of the baptismal fee at an unreasonably high rate. Although the Anglican Church in the Caribbean came under the episcopal authority of the Bishop of London, the Jamaican Assembly limited his powers by decreeing that no ecclesiastical law or jurisdiction shall have power to enforce, confirm, or establish any penal mulct or punishment in any case whatever. You have to make this distinction between the Metropolitan Church and what's happening with church bodies there and what's happening actually in the islands. So for example, the Bishop of London, the Baptist and Methodist groups and so on, headquarters based in England, don't actually have that much authority in Jamaica itself. The Jamaican legislators, the Jamaican planters, they really decide what's happening on the ground. And more of that will come out later. But in truth, the concern of the Metropolitan Anglican Church to conventionalise the slaves is not on the whole shared by the church itself in the colonies. And I've said that, so I won't dwell on that any further. In any case, the church in the Caribbean was pretty weak, and in fact it was the church of the landed gentry or the plantocracy, and made no real effort to convert the slaves anyway. I think you see a similar thing with colonial Africa. The church rather is part of the establishment, part of the established order. But it's in the very isolation of the white society from the African slave life that African belief systems were allowed to flourish, and these now form the basis of various fusions of Christianity that occurred on the islands of the British Caribbean. So I'll talk briefly about African Caribbean beliefs prior to evangelization. Slave owners and missionaries generally agreed that slaves had no religion, or only a very degraded form of it. As such, missionaries to the islands simply underestimated the resilience of African religious belief systems. African religious belief systems survived the New World through a process of adaptation. The historiographical consensus during the 20th century held that the multiplicity of African cultures in the New World actually militated against the preservation of an African worldview. However, what you actually find, well, let me just simplify that in case that was a little bit dense, probably was. There was this idea that if you grab slaves from all over the West Africa and then you land them on a plantation, that there was a sort of deliberate construction of heterogeneity so that people would not be able to form some kind of homogenous culture. It was a little actually a bit more nuanced than that. What you find is that different periods of the slave trade, different ethnic groups, different in some ways culturally, but perhaps sharing similar kind of cognitive orientations, similar belief systems, would end up landed on the same island. So for example, in Jamaica you have a predominance of Akan traditions. It is not just Akan peoples there, but the Akan group contains various other subgroups. So that, and also there was a great trade in Akan slaves at this period of time. What you see in Brazil, for example, is with the collapse of the Yoruba emperor in the late 18th century, the importation of lots of Yoruba slaves. And again, despite the differences within the Yoruba ethnic groups, nonetheless, they're able to reconstitute something of a Yoruba culture. And that's why we see today the survival of such strong Yoruba elements in Brazil, in Trinidad, and so on. So it was possible for slaves to create some kind of worldview out of some sort of shared understanding. So as I'm saying, in Jamaica, the largest ethnic group in the 18th century was the Akan and the Game people. The Akan heritage of Jamaica has been sustained by the community of the escaped slaves, or as they were commonly known, the Maroons. And the Maroon communities were formed after the Spaniards ceded control of the island to the British in 1655, and when, rather than following their old masters, 300 of their slaves took to the mountains. In due course, they were joined there by slaves escaping British plantations. And these Maroon communities preserved the more coherent Akan culture and religion than that found on the plantations, and they maintained a partial independence from British rule throughout the period. But the simple fact that their presence on the island spoke of an alternative to plantocratic oppression. It's, I think, difficult to imagine that even if there was a treaty in which, and I think Richard probably remembers the date, but after the Second Maroon War, the Maroons signed a treaty with the British government, which obliged them to return any escapes that ran away to the Maroon communities. However, I would argue that the very existence of the Maroon communities, and you have Maroon communities also in Suriname and in Brazil, just as an addition, but it's their existence there, plants something in the mind of slaves on the plantations that actually there's an alternative to what they're waking up with every day as the accepted order of things. I mean, perhaps that isn't what was there for the serfs in on the 14th century, or so, 1700s or 1100s, as Brian was talking about. But it's having some kind of alternative world view, some kind of oppositional force that I think helps to create the groundwork for rebellion. Now, in discussing the beliefs of the Akan ethnic group in the mid-18th century, the missionary W.G. Gardner wrote, "Little can be said with confidence as to the religious beliefs of these people. The influence of the Coromantines, Akan, seem to have modified, if not entirely obliterated, whatever was introduced by other tribes. They are recognized in a being called Okompong, the creator and preserver of mankind. To him praise but never sacrifice is offered. A Fassi with another being, to him was they offered first fruits, and the festival of the new year was kept in his honor. Ipogwoa was the god of the sea. The devil was represented by Obogene, a malicious being. It is said that human sacrifices were sometimes offered to appease him, but no Jamaican records, however, allude to such an event. To tutelary deities that included the departed heads of families, and the worship of such was almost the only one observed to any great extent by Africans or their descendants in Jamaica." Now, the Jamaican scholar Edward Carmen Braithwaite explains, in African Caribbean practice, religious practice, where religion had not been externalized or institutionalized as in Europe, the Obeah man was a doctor, philosopher, and priest. So that's jumping a little bit, but when an amalgamation of people are transported, what you lose is, in a very formal religious structure, you lose all that kind of nomenclature. It's difficult to reconstitute a religious system in that sense. And if we're looking at particular, say, for example, at the Yoruba community, the Babalawao, the priests, spend years and years of specialization, and there are sacred songs. So it's a complete religious system. And how do you reconstitute that? Well, it's extremely difficult. But on the other hand, because one person may carry various different kinds of knowledges, you have the medicine person who's also... The religious systems are not compartmentalized. They are interlinked. So one person can be a repository of different kinds of knowledge that would allow a community to reconstitute its sense of religion or of a religious identity. And so you have that in Jamaica, but you also have this kind of intercourse with the Maroons among the plantation slaves. I don't know if anyone knows a great deal about Obeah. Obeah is often talked about as a Jamaican religion. And in fact, Obeah is a lot more complicated than that. Obeah in the 18th century has two kind of forms. There's the Obeah man and the Okomofo, and the Obalifa. And the Okomofo is your sorcerer. So basically you pay the guy, he casts a spell, whoever pays and blah blah. The Obalifa is a completely different kind of creature. That's the religious leader who's more likely to be the person leading, supporting rebellions, the figurehead of the community. And so it's the Obeifas who are on the plantation communities in Jamaica who were consistently cropping up as supporting, fomenting rebellion. Now, the significance of slave beliefs and slave leadership went beyond the questions of syncretism and survival. Religious leaders also represented an alternative source of authority within the slave community. By providing a distinct worldview and a counter-ideology to white authority, slave religion provided psychological resistance to dehumanizing effects of slavery. Slave religion and religious practitioners would soon be kept to the, came to the driving seat behind numerous slave revolts. And in Jamaica, for example, in the slave revolt of 1760, there are numerous, that was associated quite heavily with Obia. And again, our missionary Gardner comments on the factor that led to the revolt. And said, great numbers of Negro slaves were now constantly imported from Africa. Among these, the fierce Coromantines occupied a very prominent place. It was by men of the race, Fans, Akins and Ashantis, that the insurrection of 1760 was conducted. Conspiracy extended throughout the island and was aided by the mysterious terrors of Obia and was hatched in the greatest secrecy. During the revolt, the Obia men provided protection against the white forces. The Negroes, again Gardner, were greatly stimulated by their confidence in the powers of the Obia men. The power that was distributed by these imposters, which was said to make its possessor invulnerable. Taki, described here as one of the Obia men, but I'm not quite certain if that was true, but Taki was the leader of the slave revolt. Taki, it was asserted, could even catch the bullets of soldiers and throw them back among them. Now, what we're dealing with is a confrontation between a scientific system and a mystical system. So often what the enslaved Africans were looking at was European power, military might, as a kind of a form of magic. And you could be protected from that magic by special preparations, by Obia men, by the oaths that people took, by the powders and so on. Now, the Haitian revolt involved the cult of Vaudan, and again, similarly, people felt that they took protection that was provided by the Vaudan priests. 10 minutes left, all right? My gosh, I was just relaxing. Oh well. There you go. well, there you go. So, like many others before it, the revolt of 1760 was unsuccessful, but its failure did not diminish the importance of religion to slave rebellions. Remained a powerful vehicle for protest against the plantocracy. The novelist and slave owner Matthew Lewis tells us that Obia practitioners were often believed to be responsible for poisoning masters and overseers. So sometimes we need to get away from the idea that it was always revolt. Sometimes you have low-level kinds of resistance, you know, sort of poisoning someone on the estate, curses. And even when it didn't involve Obia, there might be mutilation of cattle. Which, you know, harsh as it sounds, because you were seen as a form of property. It was a way of saying, well, you know, we're going to mess up the system somehow. But a key turning point in the development of slave religion in the Caribbean was the growth of a cult called Mialism. And Mialism was a new syncretic religion, syncretic being joining two different forms together, several forms together. So that's Christianity and an African tradition. And Mialism marked the emergence of a pan-African identity. Now, the problem for Jamaican slave revolts and many other slave revolts beforehand was that people were very much thinking of themselves and their ethnic groups as they were in Africa. So the 1760 slave revolt was predominantly led by Akans, but with the growth of a Creole community, native-born, then you get the start of a tradition that actually fuses together different kinds of African elements, so that people actually feel there is some kind of lingual factor between Africans and Creole-born that makes it possible for them to fully participate in the revolt. Now, I could talk a little about the Mayan dance and aspects of Mayanism, but I don't think that's important. Now, I'm just going to say a little bit about evangelization. Now, the first missionaries to the Caribbean were the Moravians, and they arrived in the West Indies in 1732. And the Moravian missionaries first arrived in Jamaica in 1754, they were on the Danish islands beforehand. And they kind of sold themselves to the plantocracy, at the Anglicans beforehand, saying that, you know, we can guarantee you docile slaves. And in fact, when it came to the 1831 revolt, they were very much keen to stress that none of their slaves were seen to be involved. But the syncretism with Christianity and African religion happened really with the Baptists. Now, the Baptist mission had sort of two formulas to it, or two strands. There were African-American slaves who, after the American War of Independence, came to Jamaica and started up these independent... I've got a fly here as well. I've got to contend with all the elements here. You know, you're really up against it. Yeah. So you had the tradition by African-American slaves, George Lead in particular, I mean, incredible story. George had started the first African-American slave churches in Virginia, and then came to Jamaica and started the first Baptist church there. But the churches that he left behind, or that he started, were very much sort of independent. They weren't sort of supervised by the plantocracy. So there was room for people to accommodate this mild tradition that I've just mentioned to the Christianity that Lyell had imparted, as he had understood it, and he had understood it in a syncretic way in any case. So when the British missionaries came to the islands in 1824, I think there was the arrival in particular of someone called William Nibb, who was one of the great Baptist abolitionists, to say, what they found there was a kind of Christianity which they couldn't recognise, and they started this division between what were called the native Baptist churches, these are the African syncretic churches, and the British syncretic churches. Now, if I've got enough time, I'll just talk about how that figures into the 1831 revolt. So, what the slaves did was, in some ways, take advantage of these native Baptist churches to use them as sort of sanctuaries to foment rebellions. Although they weren't under the kind of restrictions that North American slaves were, because Jamaican plantations were larger, which meant you had, in some ways, a slightly more degree of slave autonomy, still the possibilities of fomenting rebellions, especially after the 1760s, were reduced. So churches and churches and religious associations became a powerful vehicle for that. And in fact, the leader of the 1831 revolt, Sam Sharp, was a domestic slave, and he was a leader in both the Baptist mission churches and what we call the Native Baptist Church. And Sharp came to an understanding that Christianity could not be reconciled to slavery. And he's constantly reiterated the quotation, "No man can serve two masters," became a slogan among the slaves. Furthermore, he held that to protest against slavery was a matter of assisting their brethren in the work of the Lord, and this was not the work of man alone. I mean, Sharp's interesting here because in some ways it's not just that he's almost working through Christianity in a pretty orthodox theological sense. There's not the sense what he's conveying there is the Afro-syncretic understanding, but that also would have underpinned his understanding, and also particularly those who followed him, because under the other people involved in the revolt, people like Daddy Farr. Daddy was a word that they often gave to the Mile leaders in the Mile churches. These people were very much involved with the Mile tradition and using these Baptist churches basically as a way of fomenting revolts and so on. Now, news of the conspiracy reached the missionaries, the 1831 revolt, and they advised against the revolt. William Nibb, for example, preached at a meeting at Salter Field saying, "I learned that some wicked persons have persuaded you that the king had made you free. Hear me, I love your souls, I would not tell you a lie in for the world. What you have been told is false, false as hell can make it. I entreat you not to believe it, but to go to your work as usual. If you have any love for Jesus Christ, or for religion, or to your ministers, to those kind friends in England who have given money to help you build this chapel, be not led away by wicked men." Just to slightly recap there, one of the reasons, or one of the big push factors for the 1831 revolt was a because the slavery itself and the transatlantic trade in slaves had been abolished, you also found in the 1820s some efforts to ameliorate the slave trade. So slaves were allowed more time to farm and provisions. They were also, I think, given the right to marry. I'll double check that. And so people were beginning to think, well, this is coming to an end. And the fact that rumors began to spread among the slaves that had already been given their freedom, but the plantocracy was withholding it. And so this is, again, the background to the formation of the 1831 revolt, which is island-wide and Creole-led. So the Presbyterian minister, Thomas Waddell, counseled his congregation that emancipation would only come about via the parliamentary process, saying, "I assured them that it would come to them only in a peaceable and lawful way, by the efforts of their friends in Britain, and while violence on their own part would surely retard its progress and perhaps ensure their own destruction." So you're having a kind of conflict between this acquiescent Christianity, which preaches passivity among the slaves, and this, the growth of the feeling that liberation had to be claimed and taken, and it was something for slave agency. But for the most part, the exhortations of these missionaries were greeted with disdain. Nibs found that his congregation was fiercely furious and would not listen to dissuasion from engaging in such perilous enterprises. They accused their ministers of deserting them and threatened to take revenge upon them. I mean, the tradition that the slaves were coming from were of religious leadership which made it possible for it to be revolutionary. What was the point of having a slave leader who basically maintained the status quo? So this has compromised the relationship of the missionaries who had pacifist, I guess, inclinations, but also were playing the game, I think, of understanding that in Britain, slave revolts were likely to, as much as anything, feed the cause of pro-slavers. Pro-slavers were arguing that slaves, Africans, were latently barbaric, and there was no help for them, that kind of thing. So the differing stances of the European missionaries and Sam Sharp point to different perceptions of religious leadership in the affairs, so I won't dwell on that. The historian Michael Mullins has discerned that the greater the degree of independence of the European missions, the more likely it was that the slaves would engage in revolt. At all events, in 1831, the slaves were inexperienced and poorly organised combatants. So in the end, the revolt failed, partly because, again, the word had got out, the militia was prepared, and by the end of January 1832, the revolt, which began in December, had been suppressed. In the heavy reprisals that followed, the leaders of the revolt, including Sam Sharp, were executed along with 312 other revolutionaries. The aftermath of the rebellion revealed the expectations that lay beneath, so behind, the religious survival of that year. It became clear to Thomas Waddell that many churches and congregations had been swelled by hosts anticipating freedom, who now, that their hopes were disappointed, fell away. It was common for a backslide to answer an exhortation thus: "With no use, minister, what can church and prayer do for we again?" This can be taken to reflect the disillusionment of the many slaves who left the mission churches, but it also suggests that even those slaves who were not directly involved in the revolt were at least sympathetic to its aim of forcing the abolition issue. More significantly, the disillusionment with church and prayers suggests to the slaves a professional faith in a Christian God was built on a belief in the power to grant material liberty. The slaves, however, did not desert the Baptist churches entirely. The retention of the ticket and leader system ensured the fusion between Mormonism and the Baptist slaves would continue. And sorry to leave it there, but that's an unexplained point. I'm sure there's loads to pick up on, and hopefully you'll ask some questions later on. Or I'll just answer anticipated questions, I don't know. Thank you.